I'm Grady, and this is my column on architecture. The architecture of small things. I have a friend and colleague who builds tiny things. She once gave me a tractor that was far smaller than my fingertip. I made the mistake of dropping it, and it took me considerable time to find it again amid grass into which it had fallen. This tractor, although tiny, had a number of moving parts that you could appreciate if and only if you looked very, very closely. Oh, I neglected to mention that she builds these objects out of bits, not atoms. They are all virtual objects living in a virtual world, for she is a virtual girl, to paraphrase a song by Madonna. From afar, this gift looks like a mote of dust, but only when you look closely can you see the cunning patterns of which it is composed. All small things are like that. Consider, for example, the architecture of a single cell. Bruce Albert's Molecular Biology of the Cell is one of the classic comprehensive references on this subject. Well, actually, biochemists typically don't use the term architecture, instead referring to a cell's structure. In the human body, which itself has a most graceful architecture, structure, there are on the order of several tens of trillions of cells, each of which is an instance of one of a couple hundred different types. Despite their differentiation, all such human cells are eukaryotes, and thus share a common structure. Peer inside any of these cells and you'll typically find a nucleus, mitochondria, cytoplasm, the endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi vesicles, ribosomes, and so on. While our understanding of these structural components is fairly complete, there is much yet to grok about a cell's dynamics, what folks in that field call mechanisms. A cell's metabolism, cell division, the communication among neurons, how a cell knows what type it should grow to be, even the pre-programmed death of every cell and the unbridled growth of cancer cells are carried out by cunningly crafted mechanisms that operate at the molecular level. Naming these mechanisms, understanding them, and then discovering how to control them are the focus of much research in molecular biology. A brief aside, the systems biology graphical notation was somewhat inspired by the UML and is an effort by the biological community to produce a standard notation for describing the mechanisms of a cell. Not unlike our world of software, the field of biology has struggled with developing a common language for expressing the deep semantics of these complex patterns. The SBGN is an attempt to provide such a rich language. Mapping this vocabulary in the world of biology to our world of software, we observe that their mechanisms are our patterns. Actually, I often use the word pattern and mechanism interchangeably. In the field of genomic research, patterns within a gossamer strand of DNA are referred to as genomic signatures. Stem cell researchers are attempting to control the growth of said cells by placing them on substrates etched with what are called nanopatterns. No matter the phrasing, the point is that there are beautiful structures and mechanisms that define the human body, its organs, the cells that make up these organs, and even the individual cell. I speak of these as beautiful, a most human bias and characterization, because there is a profound elegance in the face of the fearsome complexity of these organic objects, an elegance that takes my breath away. Notice how these patterns appear at each level, from macro to atomic. As it turns out, there's plenty of room at the bottom to go even smaller. Richard Feynman's lecture, titled, There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, explored exactly that topic, wherein he posited the future ability to construct tiny machines by manipulating individual atoms. There's a lovely closure to this story, for in that lecture, Feynman observed that, at that scale, one would have to consider elements such as the van der Waals force, which operates at the molecular level. Indeed, this force is something of prominence in biochemistry now, as well as contemporary nanotechnology. Another brief aside, I must point out a difference in the pattern's trajectory. In the case of cellular biology, the primary focus of research is the discovery and mastery of cellular mechanisms. In the case of Feynman's nanotechnology, the primary focus of research is the imposition of patterns to make them manifest at the atomic level. There's a parallel in software-intensive systems. When we're tasked to transform an existing body of code, we try to discover and master the patterns embodied in that code. When we're creating new things, we inject new patterns and make them manifest in our code. We're both the explorers and the creators. What, then, distinguishes the architecture of tiny things from the architecture of larger things? As it turns out, not much other than scope. Beauty and elegance flow from the grounded simplicity of a small set of patterns that define an architect's an artifact's architecture, be it a nanomachine, a cell, a heart, or an ultra-large software-intensive system. At each level, we find the fundamentals I often speak of: crisp abstractions, a clear separation of concerns among elements, a balanced distribution of responsibilities, and simplicity as manifest in the presence of regular patterns. In the case of biological structures such as the cell, evolutionary forces led to the rise of particular cellular mechanisms. In the case of software-intensive systems, we are typically asked to deliver tangible, useful artifacts at a much shorter time scale than millennium. So we as architects apply our energy to inject these patterns. As it turns out, the evolutionary pressure of the marketplace and of technology shape what we do, sometimes subtly, sometimes in startling, discontinuous ways. Let's consider something really complex and currently inscrutable: the architecture of the brain. Antonio Damasio, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Southern California, has written a delightful book on this topic titled Self Comes to Mind. The focus of his work is to describe the mechanisms that give rise to consciousness and then a sense of self. I'm not by any means an expert in this space. My only qualification here is that I have the experience of having a brain that self-identifies this curious thing called I, but his work is quite approachable. Among other things, Damasio lays out the large-scale structure of the brain, which includes components such as the brainstem, the cerebellum, and the cerebrum. The cerebellum's two hemispheres can further be divided into distinct parts organized in the occipital, the parietal, the temporal, and the frontal lobes. There are other interesting squishy bits involved, but you get the idea. Moving from the macro brain to the small, within these parts you will find cortical regions that in turn are composed of neuron circuits that also in turn are made up of smaller circuits called nucleus and cerebral cortex patches. Below that we get to individual neurons and glial cells, two types of the couple of hundred types of cells found in the human body, and thus we're back to the architecture of a really small thing, the cell. Problem is, we don't yet grok the architecture of the mind, how a self arises from these squishy bits. Experts in the field have some ideas, and have so for some centuries, but we have a long way to go. Interestingly, there's a fascinating coevolution at play here, for advances in neuroscience have informed work in artificial intelligence, and vice versa. How a brain becomes a mind is far beyond our interest here, except to point out that this is somewhat a journey of the discovery of the architecture of tiny things, neurons, as they organize into systems of systems. This journey serves to identify all the classic elements of a complex systems architecture. What are the major, nearly independent components? What are their semantics? How do they relate to other components? What mechanisms, what patterns cut across these components? Back to the vocabulary of software-intensive systems. This brings us to the realm of significant design decisions and cross-cutting concerns. Knowing them, being able to name them and reason about them, reduces the entropy of the system we're looking at. These elements help us organize what is fundamental and a very complex thing, and without them, we're left with nothing more than a dripping hairball of disorganized complexity. Every system is part of some larger system, and thus small is a relative term. Every larger thing is full of smaller things, and so on. At each level, there is an architecture that we can name, and when we do, we can unlock its nature.